Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte, and I'm sitting in for Tom Hudson this week to have a little chat about a few of the issues that have been dominating the news this past week. Joining me, as always, are some of the area's finest journalists to help us make sense of it all. And we'd like to hear from you throughout this hour, too, so here's the number to call, 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. This past Monday, Governor Rick Scott signed a bill into law that legalizes a limited form of medical marijuana known as Charlotte's Web. At the same time, there's a battle brewing statewide over a constitutional amendment allowing more sweeping use of marijuana. Joining us in the studio are WLRN America's editor Tim Padgett, as well as CBS4's Jim DeFiti. And on the Skype line is Sergio Bustos. He oversees the Miami Herald's coverage of Florida and politics. It is good to have you all in here again. Welcome all.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Jim, I've seen a lot of news outlets, including CBS4, report that the governor, quote-unquote, quietly signed the Charlotte's Web bill. Why so quiet? Why no fanfare?
Well, first, let's point out that it takes only in Florida do they give us non-euphoric marijuana. That's what Charlotte's Web is. It's basically a sort of rarefied version of marijuana that doesn't give you the same sort of high that normal marijuana does, but relieves some of the issues for medical purposes. And the reason that they passed it, it's not that the legislature is suddenly enlightened on the issue of marijuana. It's that what they wanted to do was to try to blunt the attack of those who are trying to pass a more liberal marijuana measure through a statewide ballot initiative. They're hoping that folks will say, opponents of the statewide measure can now argue, well, the state has passed the marijuana law, so we don't need to pass it on a statewide level. We'll just have this non-euphoric version. Of course, the state is still trying to, the proponents of marijuana, the constitutional amendment, will argue it doesn't go far enough, it's not broad enough, it's a nice step, but it's only a step. Why he signed it quietly? Because, let's face it, the governor is still up for re-election, and, with his conservative Tea Party base, anything associating him with marijuana isn't necessarily going to play well politically for him. So that's why it's sort of very quiet and hush-hush and sort of like a bad drug deal that nobody wants to sort of be part of.
Sergio, this next question's for you. Much has been said about the fact that the Charlotte's Web bill is restrictive. What are the restrictions for patients?
Yeah. As Jim noted, the Scott has some political issues to deal with, but on the restriction wise, it's going to be highly regulated. The bill was amended at the very last hour to stiffen licensing requirements so that only Florida nursery owners with business is in operation for 30 continuous years will be allowed to grow this strain of marijuana that everyone knows is Charlotte's Web. And then Florida physicians who have been authorized to order the strain can start writing prescriptions beginning next January. And it's only going to be sold through dispensaries licensed by the state Department of Health. So all that, it's going to make it pretty strict. And some of the conditions it treats are epilepsy, Lou Gehrig's disease, and cancer. As Jim mentioned, now this ballot initiative is going to have several more different medical conditions, but it's pretty limited.
And this is a question for anybody who has this information. Sergio, Jim, do we know how many people extant, how many people in Florida right now need this low THC?
There's about 125,000 children in Florida who suffer from severe epilepsy. And those families lobbied pretty hard to persuade, reluctant legislators to open the door to a limited use. But it could also be used by adults. I don't have any numbers beyond that.
Now, Sergio, because help me, maybe I'm confused. The Charlotte's Web is the strain of marijuana that's sold now legally because the state has authorized it. But if the statewide ballot initiative passes on marijuana, the type of marijuana that could be sold through the ballot initiative once that passes, that's not restricted to just Charlotte's Web, is it?
Right. That's a much broader
right.
medical pot.
So for instance, the folks who wanted to start their own cannabis business, who opened maybe a pot shop, who wanted to grow, it's that restriction of 30 years uninterrupted service for growers, that wouldn't necessarily apply for folks who would start being able to grow marijuana if the ballot initiative were to pass, correct?
That's my understanding. Now, it depends on how they would, you know, the state would then, if the ballot passes, the state would then have to regulate it. And then, of course, the legislature could come back and say, yeah, we want those same restrictions and requirements on this ballot initiative.
Okay, we've got a couple of calls from listeners now. On the line, we have got Manuel. He's from Miami, and he says that this is long overdue. Manuel, you're on the air.
Yes, I definitely think that it is long due to relax the marijuana laws, especially for medical purposes, of course, but not just for children, also adults. I do understand that there is now proof that marijuana does relieve eye pressure on glaucoma sufferers, which there are many of them in this in this state, and also relieves pain on certain cancer patients. But I think the main reason should be to decriminalize marijuana use and take it out of the hands of organized crime. It's just a matter of time. Just look at what's happening in Colorado.
Manuel, thank you. This raises an interesting question. Where are adults in this conversation, the adults that need it medically?
Well, what will end up happening is the way the larger bill is written, again, separating out the Charlotte's Web version from what happens if the ballot initiative passes, if it gets 60% of the vote in November, the way the bill is written is if it would be for any debilitating disease. Now, how do you define debilitating? Well, that's up for a doctor to decide. So if there's a doctor who's willing to say that what your symptoms are debilitating, then theoretically he could write you, you know, a note allowing you to get a card, which would then put you in the process of being able to go to what would then be set up as pot shops around the state, and you would be able to go in and buy your different strains of marijuana that you wanted to.
Well, and tighter oversight is going to be an issue for this broader bill just as much as it was for Charlotte's Web. For example, last week we interviewed South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and even though she says she doesn't really have a position on the broader bill, she made it clear that she's very skeptical or worried about whether or not the broader referendum bill will have, tighter oversight. She points to the fact that Florida has a very bad track record when it comes to tighter oversight on things like painkillers. So I think that's one of the areas where the proponents of the broader bill have their work cut out for them to convince people that there is going to be, the kind of restrictions that people were lobbying for the Charlotte's Web.
But the interesting thing, too, is, and I'm sure Sergio can jump in, is that you got to be careful when you pass one of these ballot initiatives, because what then turns around is if the state gets too restrictive, right, if they create such a scenario that it almost makes it virtually impossible to either grow or sell or provide marijuana if the ballot measure were to pass, then the proponents can go into court and demand that the state pass more liberal regulations. So it's going to be an interesting test. I'm sure the state's first pass will be to be very restrictive, and they may have to get pushed back on it by the courts.
And what happened with the bill that passed, they put those tougher licensing requirements to, you know, because they want to test how this works out, and they're hoping by putting in the stiffer requirements they can kind of keep this under control and have some at least authority to restrict it or, you know, to keep it going. But, you know, again, they come back next year and they can rewrite the laws as well.
And we've got another call from one of our listeners. We've got David calling in from Fort Lauderdale. He says the bill doesn't go far enough. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, sir. When you say that the bill doesn't go far enough, I'm assuming that you're talking about just Charlotte's Web.
Well, yes. Well, Charlotte's Web specifically, but also I believe that all these strains of marijuana should be allowed for all the conditions and illnesses that it helps, including chronic pain, cancer, and glaucoma.
Okay. David, thank you very much for your call. Thank you. You know something, Jim? CBS4 just reported on the, let's just call it cannabis, that already ahead of November's vote, there are already marijuana business schools springing up all over South Florida. What are they teaching? What are they instructing in?
Well, that's mostly just folks cashing in on the early wave of it. Really, nobody knows, just as we've been talking about, until the legislature... Well, first, we can't put the cart before the horse. First, it's got to pass in November, and it's got to get 60% of the vote. Most polls say it's going to pass, but, you know, let's wait and see. So it's got to get 60% of the vote. After it passes, then there's the law lays out a timetable in which the legislature has to sort of provide rules and regulations. And then it's sort of there's a timing that goes through all this. I think these cannabis, you know, ventures are just trying to sort of catch early buzz and rake in a little early money. Whether, you know, I don't know what they could be training since the rules and regulations haven't been established yet.
Well, they're also putting out some fairly exaggerated estimates of how much, for example, tax money could be, you know, what kind of industry that could be, you know, they're putting out figures out there as high as $1 billion, and, you know, in terms of what Florida could be, you know, what kind of revenue we could be seeing year by year.
And then a house owned before we get a Twinkie and Hostess cupcake tax, and, you know, that'll come along, and that could save the state right there.
And while all of this was going on in Florida this past week, a huge announcement regarding marijuana was made in Jamaica last week. And for more details on that, Tim, we turn to you. Jamaica's justice minister announced that the country will decriminalize the possession of, quote unquote, small amounts of marijuana. How exactly small is small? What are we talking about?
About 57 grams or 2 ounces, which, you know, is not insignificant. But the reason that they did this, they're saying, is that they've got simply have too many youths in Jamaica who have been busted and have gotten criminal convictions, and that makes it harder for them to get things like jobs. And you have your whole young generation, you know, coming into adulthood with that kind of problem. And they said that was one of the major impetuses. But you've got the whole Caribbean, really. After what they saw happen in Colorado and Washington State, you've got the whole region there on the cusp of legalizing marijuana. And I think Jamaica, particularly Prime Minister Portia Simpson Miller, Jamaica sees itself as sort of a leader on issues like this in the Caribbean. And so it didn't surprise me that they were the first ones to sort of come out and do it.
Okay, so what evidence do you have, though, that this is a growing trend in Latin America and
Caribbean? Oh, I mean, I think you've got, you know, the chairman of CARICOM, the Caribbean Community, Ralph Gonsalves. I think he's probably, you know, backing this as well. And they're seeing what's happening all over Latin America. Uruguay, you know, this Jamaica now is the second country in Latin America and the Caribbean behind Uruguay, which last year went ahead and legalized the sale and possession of marijuana. So I think that there is this feeling that across the region, there is a trend to legalize marijuana because it's also a statement. It's a political statement to the United States that, look, you're the one that's consuming these drugs. We're the ones who are suffering the bloodshed that comes with the trafficking of the drugs. So I do think we're going to see more of this.
Jim?
I think ultimately, you know, the very first caller you had talked about, you know, we need to start looking at the issue of decriminalization, and we're slowly sort of, you know, it's the camel's nose under the tent sort of thing. Because I think we do need to have that discussion about decriminalization. The same way that Jamaica was worried about, you know, their youths being arrested for and having criminal records because of this. I mean, you look at, I mean, let's tie recent events together. You had, you know, the stories out of Miami Gardens in which 50,000 individuals were stopped and frisked, you know, and released. But thousands and thousands and thousands of people who get stopped and frisked for no good reason will end up with a criminal record because they might have a marijuana joint on their person. And so suddenly you realize that the marijuana laws in this country disproportionately affect African American youth and African Americans who get caught up in that system of being stopped by police, you know, being shaken down. And if they have some, they may have been stopped for one reason, but then they get arrested for the marijuana and now they've got a charge on their record and suddenly they're in the system. You don't see that in the Anglo communities nearly the extent. You don't see these types of programs in Pinecrest or Aventura, you know, or you know, Coconut Grove, you know, the white part of the Grove, not necessarily the black part of the Grove. So at some point, I think we do have to try to determine what damage are we doing to people in general with the marijuana laws we have. That's not part of this discussion that we're having yet on the November ballot initiative, but every step we take this way is where we're heading, is to eventually have that discussion.
And going back to Manuel's call, I think what surprises me about the Jamaica move is that it really doesn't go far enough if one of the things, as they said, they want to address is the criminality. Mm-hmm. But Jamaica has one of the highest murder rates in the world. And if you want to really get at that violence that is a result of drug trafficking, I would have expected Jamaica to just completely decriminalize and legalize not just the consumption, but also the sale, as Uruguay did, because Uruguay also was saying that it wanted to hit the drug cartels in their pocketbooks. So I really don't understand why Jamaica just didn't go the whole nine yards on this, if that's one of their impetuses.
Absolutely an issue with far-reaching effects, and we've got to take a little break right now. When we return, we take a look at how South Florida compares to the rest of the country when it comes to speedy care for military veterans. Plus, new figures bring us a clearer picture of what kinds of insurance plans Floridians are signing up for under Obamacare and how much they cost. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. And just a reminder that we would like to hear from you, so please call us with questions or comments at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN. An issue grabbing headlines nationwide for several weeks now shines a spotlight on just exactly how this country takes care of its military veterans. Last month, Eric Shinseki resigned as Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs amid allegations that VA workers around the country had hidden information on how long patients waited to see doctors. And there are claims that those long wait times possibly contributed to the deaths of dozens of veterans. In the studio with us once again, CBS4's Jim DeFede, and joining us now is Kelly Kennedy. She's a reporter for the Associated Press. Kelly, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Jim, recently you did an investigative report looking into how long the wait times are at South Florida's VA hospitals.
Any vet will tell you that the process of getting to a doctor is unbelievably slow and inefficient.
That was Mark Schenker. He's an Air Force veteran from Fort Lauderdale. And Jim, you interviewed him. What was his story?
It was remarkable. Mark Schenker told me three stories of his encounters with the VA. And he was very proud to sign up for the VA. He wanted to be part of the VA. And he credits the VA for actually saving his life. The first time he needed the VA care, he needed an aortic bypass. He needed an aortic valve removed and repaired. He got that done. He got in within a few months, no problem. The next two times, when he had other surgery issues, though, he ended up getting through tremendous wait lines. At one point, he needed surgery for an issue and had to wait 14 months, was put on a waiting list for surgery for 14 months. When he finally did get the surgery, he needed to go back for a hernia operation. He waited 9 months just to be able to see a doctor to be told, yes, you do need the surgery, and was again put on a waiting list. And so he finally said, I had to give up on the VA and go to a private physician and a private surgeon and have the surgery done that way. And his story really gets to the heart of the issue. Veterans who get to see their doctors in the VA generally love their doctors. They think that the doctors who treat them give them very good care. It's getting the access to the doctors, getting the appointments. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've learned through our reporting is that the VA is just overwhelmed in certain specialties. Some of it is just bureaucratic foul-up in terms of, you know, how you schedule people and the process of scheduling them. But others, it's clear that there's just a shortage of doctors in certain areas, and that causes backlogs and backjams.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. Meanwhile, South Florida congressional delegates met with the head of the Miami VA, Paul Russo, this week. And before that meeting, this is what he had to say to them.
Miami VA is working hard to improve access to veterans. In some areas, we do have some access issues. Our numbers are getting better and they're coming down.
Getting better and coming down. Kelly, you've been reporting extensively on this issue as well. And last week, the VA had some statewide breakdowns. So in Florida, from your reporting, what have you been able to gauge about the average wait time for a veteran seeking care in one of the state's VA hospitals?
It really depends on where you're at. And Miami had the absolute worst wait time to see a primary care physician. It was 43 8 days in Miami and 57 days to see a specialist in Miami. Now, that happened to be the worst in the state, but compared to in Honolulu, it was 145-day wait to see specialists. So in Miami did terribly in Florida. Nationally, it wasn't quite as bad.
And Jim, you just spoke about the specialties. I mean, are there longer wait times for different things? What was the breakdown there?
I don't have all the exact numbers in front of me, but I mean, it depended. For instance, let's say you needed audiology. Audiology was particularly bad. If you needed a hearing aid or if you had concussive damage, maybe from serving in Iraq or Afghanistan and had ear damage, waiting to see an audiologist, we showed that new patients coming into the system, there were at least 200 who are waiting more than 90 days, some cases well in excess of 90 days, just to get that first appointment with an audiologist.
But is that because of a just general lack of audiologists, trained audiologists in South Florida, or
in
the VA system?
Within the VA system. And that's why one of the fixes that they are finally willing to take, and look, what's infuriating about this is the VA has known about these problems for years. There has been inspector general report after inspector general report talking about wait times. It's only now that it's risen in the national press, first out of Phoenix, but now across the country. Nearly every state reporters are doing stories on what exactly is happening in the VA in their local communities. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, the VA is finally doing some common sense fixes, such as authorizing overtime, bringing in more doctors, and most importantly, if they can't see you, if I can't schedule an appointment for you to see, let's say, an audiologist for 4 or 5 or 6 months, I'm going to give you the authority now to go see a private physician, and we'll help pay for that.
Okay. Kelly, now, what is the stated reason for these long waits? What's the official reason for all the long waits? What are they saying?
Well, one of the things they were doing is they were requiring this, 14-day wait time was the target. And of course, I think that's sort of what started all of the problems, is because they were goals that nobody could absolutely
right, unrealistic.
Meet. And okay. So now I think what they've acknowledged that there's a problem. Obviously, the secretary has resigned. And so it's a looking forward. What are we doing now? 15% of the 731 facilities around the country, including some in Florida, are going to have to be revisited and require additional investigation. So it's sort of just the tip of the iceberg. We know there's long wait times, but what about the quality of care that's going on in these facilities? We've heard about patients' deaths, patients falling, the wrong catheters being put in, all sorts of things and complaints.
In South Florida, I mean, do you have evidence? This is for the both of you now. Let me put it bluntly. Who has died in South Florida, or how many have died because of these wait times?
You know, the state of Florida has filed a lawsuit against the VA. They've listed two patients in that lawsuit. But in addition, there is a letter attached to that lawsuit from anonymous employees at the West Palm Beach VA facility. And they go on and on about problems about a patient who died because the wrong needle was inserted into their arm and they had a complication, and just things that were very preventative, and they very clearly spelled it out in that letter.
Jim, the charges that nationwide VA office staffers were told to basically cook the books, alter information about the wait times, to hide the actual wait times. Any indication, this is for the both of you now, actually, any indication that this has been going on in South Florida, this cooking of the books?
They say no. And the 15% of hospitals that are going to be revisited, I know that Miami and West Palm are not on one of those 15%. The 15% are where they had employees basically saying that, yes, we were told to lie or we were told to do something disingenuous. That wasn't the case in Miami. They claim, the Miami director, when I finally did track him down, and by the way, when you played that sound clip from Paul Russo, the director, that was us having to ambush him outside of an office because he's refused to publicly speak, he and the chief of staff. And that's one of the complaints, is that they failed to be transparent. And members of the congressional delegation in South Florida, both Democrat and Republican I've spoken to, says the VA, whether it's locally or nationally, needs to be more forthcoming with information, because they need to win back the public's trust. Because let's face it, if veterans do not believe they're going to get able to see a doctor or get good health care, the ramifications of that could be deadly if people just sort of give up and not go in, particularly in the area of mental health. If veterans don't think they're going to be able to go in and see a psychiatrist or psychologist, and those are specialties, by the way, that have long wait times. But if they think they're not going to be able to be served in a timely manner and they don't get the help they need, well, that's a danger for all of us.
Kelly, you just made a reference a couple of seconds ago to, now that the state has identified the problem, what are they going to be doing about it? So what is the plan of attack here?
They're actually doing a number of things already. They are starting to contact more than 90,000 veterans who are already waiting for care around the country to accelerate their appointments. They are hiring additional staff for the most overburdened facilities. They're using temporary measures like mobile medical units to accelerate care. And then, of course, these new investigations to sort of see... Okay, let's dig a little bit deeper. And those weren't in Miami, but they were in Gainesville, Bay Pines, Lake City, and Pensacola facilities.
That's the VA nationally. You had asked about the state. What's the state doing?
Right.
And that's not what the state's doing.
The state's just filing a lawsuit.
Right. The state's just suing. And let's face it, there's a little bit of grandstanding. This is a great issue for Governor Scott, you know, to be able to try to say, I'm forcing my way into the medical facilities. And so there's a little bit of that at play here. But there's a lot of oversight now. There is the Justice Department is now criminally investigating, you know, the VA when they find signs that there may be abuse in which it led to patient deaths, whether long wait times. And really the heart of the matter was the VA had created a system that was unrealistic. What you mentioned earlier, the 14-day wait times. They set a goal of saying we will see patients within 14 days. And bonuses, which is a big part of the VA system for its directors and its executive staff, bonuses were tied to being able to meet those wait times. So there was a financial incentive to be able to say that you saw patients within a timely manner, which is why you saw a secret list develop so that the real numbers were never being shown.
And that has stopped. Bonuses are no longer going to be tied to that. I mean, they've done away with a 14-day wait time, but they're also no longer going to be, you know, tying bonuses.
When you say that has stopped, as of when did it stop?
When the scandal came out a couple of weeks ago, finally Shinseki, one of his last acts as Secretary of the VA was to say no more bonuses, at least this year.
Okay. If you've got a question for us, please call us at 800-743-WLRN. Once again, 800-743-9576, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN. On the subject of health care, a new federal report is filling in a few blanks about how Obamacare is doing in the Sunshine State. Now, the vast majority of Floridians who signed up for coverage under the president's health care law are paying $100 or less a month, or less, rather, a month in premiums on average. Kelly, what did the government data exactly show about what Floridians are paying for insurance?
You have 75% of Floridians are paying $100 or less. 56% of them are paying $50 or less. And you've got to remember, I think the important thing to remember is that Florida, we had more than 1 million people sign up here. That's more than any other of the 36 states using the federally facilitated exchange. And the big issue here, 91% of those 1 million people who signed up got a tax credit. So taxpayers are paying a lot of money for these Floridians.
And I have to confess, when I saw that 91%, that jumped out at me.
It's a huge number.
Holy mackerel. And you've been covering this issue for a long time. So when you saw that about the tax subsidy, what was your first reaction?
It's a big number, and it is higher than the national rate. The national rate, taxpayers are subsidizing 76% of it. It questions CBO reports on how much is this really going to cost the federal government at the end of the day. Because the big draw to get everybody into the system was, hey, the care is going to be affordable because of these tax subsidies, which of course taxpayers are, you know, picking up. And so is this going to be sustainable at these huge rates?
Well, right. There's a couple ways to look at it. One, the 91% figure shows that Florida has a lot of very poor people who were in need of health insurance. Two, if you're going to start talking about the ultimate cost of taxpayers, it's really tricky because, yes, we're subsidizing those policies now, but because they have health insurance, presumably they will be starting able to get the type of care they need, maybe preventative care, and they don't end up in our emergency rooms. If you have insurance, you're not ending up in the Ryder Trauma Center in Miami or the Jackson Memorial Hospital ER, which is going to cost taxpayers a whole lot more money. If you have to use the ER as your doctor, you know, then that's cost us a lot more money. If you subsidize a little bit now and get them to see primary care physicians on a regular basis, the long-term savings may result.
And Jim, that information about the patients and their habits, Kelly, I'm assuming that this is what insurance companies use for their pricing structures. Am I wrong when it comes to premiums?
How much they're using there's so many things they use on their premiums. How many sick people they expect to get in the pool, the age groups. So it's really hard right now to see what the rates are going to be filed very soon, within the next month or so.
Because there have been a number of news outlets that are reporting that, the premiums for 2015 are just going to be hunky-dory, terrific. And then I'm seeing others that are saying it's going to be a death spiral.
No, I do. It seems like there's going to be an increase. Probably it seems, of course, there's been a ton of reports because it's such a political hot potato. But it seems like probably something around the more 8-10% increase, which really isn't that high when you consider that in the past rates have increased 20% and 30%.
But you're also going to likely see, because so many Floridians started signing up, because it was so successful in Florida, you're likely to see more health insurance carriers coming into the state wanting to participate.
Absolutely, and we're seeing that nationally already. More insurers, and that will lower costs.
That will lower costs as well. The other thing, too, is that we're going to wait and see is you know, when the enrollment period opens up again next year for the next round, does the state of Florida stay on the sidelines? Does the state of Florida decide to let the federal government run the exchange? Or does the state now sort of say, all right, that horse has sort of left the barn. Now do we sort of play catch up and take a little bit more ownership?
The state of Florida has shown absolutely no interest.
I talked to the incoming speaker of the House, and he actually said now that this has happened the way it has and that so many Floridians have signed up, they are open to the idea of creating a Florida exchange, because at its heart, it's a very Republican idea. You don't want the national government dictating your exchange. You want it controlled on the local level. And that's what was always odd about the Florida decision not to participate in
the exchange. And all of the Republican states. They all turned it over to the federal government.
Which is supposedly anathema to what their
exactly.
core value. But the other question, too, is we still want to know about whether or not they're going to accept the Medicaid money. And there's still a whole lot of hundreds of thousands of people who will be benefit from Medicaid. And that's money that, again, 95% or 90% of the federal government would come in and pay and subsidize that care. But that the state refused to 100% initially.
First 3 years and then 90% after that. Right. And you know, we've got more than a million people that would benefit from that in Florida. And when I would do interviews for people who were signing up for the Affordable Care Act, I would talk to those counselors who were signing people up, and I would say, give me an estimate. How many people start the process and then do you think sign up at the end? And they said, less than 50%. I would say, why? Because they fall into the Medicaid expansion gap. And it wasn't people who were sitting home not working. It was college students, people who were just barely scraping by. And so the Medicaid expansion gap in Florida is large. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of money that Florida is missing out on. And there's really been little movement in Florida.
The governor's race could change that, though. Depending on who wins the next round of the governor's race, if Charlie Crist were to win, I think you would see him seize the bully pulpit.
Absolutely.
And really put a lot of pressure on the legislature to consider it.
This is a question for the two of you. In the course of your reporting, have you ever come across an Obamacare detractor, an Obamacare hater who said, I'm just like not going to sign up for it, but who later did sign up for it and now turned out to love it?
Not off the top of my head. Look, I think people will do ultimately what's in their best interest. And if in their best interest is to get health insurance and have it subsidized by the federal government, I think at the end of the day, they'll take it.
Okay. You just spoke a second ago about the governor's race. The Affordable Care Act, big target for Rick Scott. He led the lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. This year's governor's race may be one mainly about personality. And the focus this week was about the big difference in financial assets between Governor Rick Scott and former Governor Charlie Crist, and what it says about the type of governor they would be. Governor Scott disclosed his financial information, and he challenged Charlie Crist to do the same.
Here's what I did. I released my financial statements, even though that was not what I had to do. I put my assets into a blind trust. I think it's the right thing to do if you're a governor. You ought to put your assets in blind trust so you don't have a conflict. But we also released our tax returns. Charlie Crist needs to take our lead. He needs to release his tax returns of he and his wife. We'll find out if he believes in transparency or not.
Okay, Jim, what did we learn from the governor's returns?
He's rich. I mean, at the end of the day, that was my takeaway. He's rich. And he's got plenty of money to pump into his own campaign if he wants to, and that's what makes him formidable. Along with the improving economy, whether he deserves credit for it, or whether Obama deserves credit for it, or whether it's just a natural cycle of business, the governor gets to be running at a time when the economy is improving, unemployment is coming down. He's got some good things to sort of argue that he should stake the course. And he's got a whole lot of bankroll to be able to do it, which is why he's up with commercials and Charlie Crist really hasn't been on the media at all. And why the race has tightened so much.
And I think why perhaps Charlie has revisited this issue of the Medicare fraud issue for Rick Scott. How did you make your millions? And bringing up this issue of, you know, the largest Medicare fraud at the time perpetrated against the country.
Yeah, I don't know how good that, it's funny because that's the same argument that Alex Sink made 4 years ago, and I don't think it necessarily stuck. And
so it didn't then, but will it be different now because Charlie is a better candidate in the sense that he will be able to use it more with his just sort of personality and with his.
This is for both of you. What has Charlie Crist been doing for these post-gubernatorial years? What exactly has he been doing?
He's been working in John Morgan's law firm, and John Morgan is the main backer of the marijuana initiative. And he's been, you know, making some money himself, and he's made some investments, and he's worked in John Morgan's personal injury firm, and he's made some good change there. He made about $200,000 or $300,000 a year salary from there. So look, Charlie's not hurting for cash. I don't know how his book sales did. I think they may be better than Hillary's in some ways, but he's done fine.
And we need to take a break now. When we come back, usually school board elections are not much to write home about, but a race in Palm Beach County is raising eyebrows because of the rather interesting background of one of the candidates involved. That's coming your way right after the break. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMattei. A Boca Raton math tutor is making a run for a seat on the Palm Beach County School Board. Nothing unusual about that, except that this candidate is a former porn actor. In the studio with us is 38-year-old David Mack. He is running on a platform that includes more focus on technology, innovation, and secular values in schools, as well as more sex education. David, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
And joining us is David's opponent for the District 3 school board seat. We say hello to John Hartman. John, hello.
How are you? Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, David, correct me if I'm wrong. You worked in the porn industry until about 4 years ago?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Okay. More recently, you've been running a math tutoring business.
Mm-hmm. For the last couple of years, yep.
What made you leave the adult entertainment field?
Ironically, technology. there was a lot of free and pirated content on Tube and Torrent sites, respectively, that really kind of eroded the profitability of the business. So my decision to sort of leave the adult industry was more of a business decision, because the adult media business is like any other business. It's a business, and it just didn't make sense economically to stay. I didn't have any moral reservation whatsoever in my decision to leave.
How many films did you make while you were in the industry?
When I was in the business, it's interesting that you say films, because it's really more done by scenes. If you do five scenes, that could end up in one movie, right? But if you do, one scene in five different movies, now you're in five movies. And then they do compilations. So somebody could take content that I've shot, 20 years ago and release a movie next week.
Forgive my ignorance about the porn industry. I mean,
do you get paid by scene or by movie? You get paid by the scene. And I've been in over 100 scenes in my career in the adult film industry.
Over 100 scenes. Mm-hmm. Okay. John, you don't have as colorful a background as David here, okay?
I do not.
What do you think about your opponent as a guy? Just a regular guy.
You know, what's interesting is we just spoke out there for probably 20 or 30 minutes, and I will tell you that it was a pretty amazing conversation, because immediately we have tremendous respect for each other. We come from very disparaging views, but the respect for each other is certainly there. And I'm looking forward to talking, having an intellectual conversation about these issues. And I can't say anything negative about him whatsoever. I'm looking forward for the conversation.
Absolutely. I feel the same way about John.
Well, tell us about these differing views. Where do you differ with Dave?
I think our main difference stems from how we define morality, and that's what we were speaking about there. It's a tough issue in our country, because the question is, can you legalize morality? Is there a legal connotation of morality? And that's where the issue would come in as far as what do we want to bring into our schools? And I think that's where the issue is. I come from more of a Judeo-Christian principle background, mm-hmm. and Dave does not. But that's doesn't you know that I think that's where we're different.
Okay, and David, there are a lot of issues facing all school districts. I mean, Palm Beach County has a huge school district. I think it's the 11th largest in the United States, 5th largest in Florida. It's gigantic. We've got crumbling schools. We've got overcrowded schoolrooms. We've got teachers who are just not getting paid enough. So, I mean, is really now the best time to get into morality in schools, Dave?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
why?
You hear all the time in the news about teachers, good educators who are losing their jobs for perfectly lawful conduct on their own time. Think about the banker argument they use in Wall Street. They say, you know, we need to cap these bonuses that we're paying these bankers. If you start limiting executive compensation on Wall Street to, say, $200,000, the best bankers are going to leave, and they're going to start their own hedge funds, and then you're going to have these mediocre middle managers running these large organizations that are likely to fail, and you'll have greater unemployment. So the idea that we live in a society where teachers are paid very low, and, you know, they have to live their lives under a microscope. They can't go to a beach wearing a thong bikini on the weekend because they might lose their job. What competent teacher wants to put up with that? If I'm, why do you think I don't teach? Why do you think I own my own tutoring business? You know, if Palm Beach County offered me a job as a teacher today, I would turn it down. Why would I want to make less money to make more hours, to work more hours, to live under more of a microscope? It makes absolutely no sense.
John, you're holding back some giggles.
No,
talk to me.
You know, because I think Dave's bringing up the point, you know, to answer your question, is this the time to have this discussion? I don't think it's a bad time to have the discussion from the fact that we have a concept about our teachers, our politicians, clergy, that they're held to a higher moral standard, that they're, and so the question is that real? Is that important? I would argue that there has to be a moral standard for people that are in charge of our children. That's part where I would differ from him. But at the same time, we have to examine the fact that if teachers are following the law, then that's something that needs to be said. Like, as he brought up the issue of a teacher wearing a bikini, mm-hmm. you know, I would agree with him on that, but a teacher going out and getting a DUI, that's unacceptable.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's talking about the law versus not the law. And the thing is morality is subjective. There's not an objective morality. Why is it that social conservatives who have a problem with my lawful involvement in adult media, how does that discount, say, the PETA organization? Most people who are members of PETA believe that eating meat is immoral. So can we fire teachers who are eating meat if the principal happens to be a PETA member?
Okay, but John, do you have an objection to Dave's being on the school board based upon his background?
His background is, we all have aspects of our background that I would have things in my background I'm not proud about. Now, the thing is, what's funny is we were talking about this, Dave doesn't have a problem with his background. Now, here's what I would say. My concern with Dave is the fact that the views that he wants to implement in our schools are contrary to what I think our schools were founded on.
Okay, like
the Judeo-Christian principle is that those are things that, for me, that is that concept of morality. That is that fact that we follow the Ten Commandments, we abide by those things. He would disagree with that from his perspective.
But wouldn't you say that you know, private Christian or private Catholic schools are founded on Judeo-Christian principles? I'm a product of the New York City public school system, and I can tell you it was not, to my observation, it was not founded on Judeo-Christian principles.
Right, I understand. But I think that might be part of where our country is going in a different direction, and I don't agree with that direction. I think what made our country great was when we stuck to Judeo-Christian principles in our schools. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm suggesting we should teach religion at school or anything like that. What I'm saying is that, you know, for example, I teach history. Mm-hmm. If I'm teaching history, the history of the Jewish people, the history of Christ, that's important to the concept of history. We can't phase that out. And I'm not suggesting that Dave would even want to do that. But
I would suggest that we would teach all religions, not just Judaism, but to teach kids that the world has more than 10,000 different religions, that the doctrines of Islam and the doctrines of Christianity are completely different. They're mutually exclusive. One, you have to accept the divinity of Jesus Christ or you're going to hell. One, you have to accept the divinity of Muhammad or you're going to hell. So merely by probability alone, hundreds of millions of people are destined for damnation, just on probability alone from two religions. So my issue, but real quick, my issue on the secular values end with Judeo-Christian is that teen pregnancy is a public health emergency. And the reason that we don't have condoms in schools stems from religious organizations. It's not the public health department.
Okay.
It's none of that. It's purely religious opposition.
We will get to sex ed in a minute because mm-hmm. it's an important part part of your platform. It's important to note that we did reach out to the Palm Beach County School Board about this whole discussion. We invited them on the show. They declined to participate because of the pending election, but also because of a lawsuit. David, tell us about the lawsuit.
Well, I can't comment on, you know, pending litigation, but I can tell you that as a matter of transparency, the complaint is, if you go to my website, mecforpbcschools.com, you can download the complaint. It's public information. Read it. Do what you will with it, but I can't comment on the
okay, but
litigation.
I can. Purportedly, absolutely. All right? When the Palm Beach County School Board found out about your background in the porn industry, they pulled some advertisements for your tutoring business. Okay. No
That's
comment.
What it says. I can
comment
ask,
for him.
Ask John what he thinks about can, my. Ask John what go, he thinks about
ahead,
the lawsuit.
Go ahead, John.
You know, we had this discussion out in the lobby, and while I disagree with Dave as far as his lifestyle choices, we disagree on a lot of our values. One thing I will always defend, though, is a person's right to make a living if it's under the context of the law. I don't believe that, and again, I don't want to step out over my bounds as far as getting into the legal discussion, but I will say, in my understanding of his situation, he didn't do anything wrong. The school took down his advertising that they had given him permission to do once they found out that he had done pornography.
So you are agreed on this too?
But what kind
of a campaign, heated campaign is this going to be when you guys agree on so darn much?
I'm going to donate to John's campaign.
But the thing is, this is the issue in our country that should highlight this situation, because we do have contrary views on everything, you know, from God, I'm sure, to even education. By the way, Dave, I do disagree with you about the technology. That's another issue. We can talk about that.
Sure.
But to talk about this though, how refreshing is it to have people that have two disparaging views on morality, on God, on ethics, on morality, but yet still be able to have respect? Because one thing about me is I will defend anybody's right to have an opinion and express it, even though I may disagree with it. That's
absolutely
part of what our country, and by the way, that is those Judeo-Christian values that we were founded on.
Now, the other thing, let me add one more thing too.
Sure.
That is this idea of I don't understand why school boards are explicitly concerned with role models only in the domain of sexuality. I mean, there's plenty of different ways to be a role model. I mean, one of the we have a huge nutrition issue, you know, physical fitness in the United States. Why aren't we firing teachers who are overweight as being poor role models for health and fitness? Why aren't we firing teachers eating fast food because they're not good role models for nutrition? Why only in the domain of sexuality?
Okay. We did, as a point of interest, we did hear from District 3 Representative, the incumbent Karen Brill, and she left us this comment.
Mr. Meck has the right to run and to share his positions, and I look forward to continuing to serve the people in my district.
Okay, so let's just, John is laughing
it's
again.
Very political response.
let's just wrap it up. Talk to the people of Palm Beach County right now, the parents and the teachers, and each of you tell them why you're the best person for this job.
All right.
John, you.
I'm the best person for the job because I've been in the schools. I've been in the classroom. I have a firsthand understanding of what it is to have a child in the schools. My goal is to try to restore some ethics, some consistency. And I think one thing Dave and I would definitely agree on, and I know I can cut you off, is we need consistency on the board, and we have not had that.
I'm not saying that I am the best candidate. I'm saying that I'm offering a vision for the future of the school board, as are the other candidates, and that the voters should choose the vision that they represent with the most, and the byproduct of that will be winning the election. And just for the record, for those that are listening, Karen, the incumbent, introduced legislation for dress codes for parents. If you think parents should have dress codes at school board meetings, then vote for Karen.
Okay. District 3 Palm Beach County School Board candidates David Meck and John Hartman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to
our
guests today. That wraps up this Florida Roundup for Friday, June 20th, 2014. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or we'll post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chan and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mayers. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary, the man behind the glass over there. I'm Christine DiMattei.